All right, let me say hello first. We're good? All right, so good. I was going to say good morning, but I'm going to say good afternoon. And thank you so much for coming out to a conversation that I know is very pertinent, and it's only taken us 600 years to get to. So I'm very excited about having a part of it. I think that this is a conversation that has been happening right across the country. And it's a very important one, and I think it's about time that we had it. So I want to talk to you about a number of different kinds of things as I'm here today. But before I do that, I just want to, because I know it's also considered important, I want to acknowledge the land that we're on and acknowledge the waters that that sustain us. Indigenous peoples lived on these territories for millennia, and we have forgotten that in so many different kinds of ways. And I just want to acknowledge that. And I want to say for all of us that we also need to acknowledge the planet, and we need to acknowledge the fact that each one of us would not be able to be here and have children and grandchildren if we didn't understand how closely, directly related we are to this globe. And we need to be very cognizant of that. So I think that we should always start with that kind of acknowledgement. So the title of this conversation is, now that we've reconciled, have we got reconciliation? And I guess what I really want to say is we don't have reconciliation. We're not likely to have reconciliation for probably, let's say, 20 years. Let's keep it short. But probably it's going to take us a lot longer than that. But what we have reconciled ourselves to is the fact that we have to have the conversation in the first place. And I hope that that's what you have decided for yourselves, that you're going to engage in this conversation. I don't know how many of you have actually looked at the 94 calls to action that were put together by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Some of them are now amongst you, and we're going to have a conversation about that as we move ahead. But for the fact, because the title says, do we have reconciliation, I want to say right off the hop, we don't. We don't have it because we haven't yet been able to reach enough people to have the conversation about where we need to go. And I'm going to ask you to have a conversation amongst yourself at some point when we get there. The first thing I want to talk about, though, is a little bit about the whole question of history and what happens in a country like Canada when it's celebrating 150 years. That's what we're doing this year. And what it says to you as a population living here, and many of your ancestors having come here from other places, you're, of course, in a celebratory mood. I want you to think about the fact that 150 years is really just a drop in the bucket when it comes to how other people, in particular the Indigenous people of Canada, view this place. And I want you to think about ways in your own mind that you can actually create a sense of inclusion for what they have suffered and what they have to celebrate. In fact, I think we have to celebrate the fact that we're still here. I said, kids all the time, hey, the fact that we still have brown faces in the audience tells me that we are a very strong people, that in spite of many attempts to erase us from the face of this particular country, a continent really, we're still here, and I think that that's something to celebrate. But I want you to think about how do we actually make that, look at those impacts that have occurred over the course of time. And usually, when I have the ability, I start the conversation with some different images on what I call, what we now have identified as historic trauma. The impacts from contact that have left many Indigenous peoples still reeling from that, because of what happened. And you might say, well, that happened a long time ago. Why are they not past that? Why don't they just get on with it? Why are they still struggling? And I want you to understand a couple things about historic trauma. Historic trauma occurred at contact and is related to the epidemics and the warfare and the dislocation and the missionization and all of those impacts that occurred. The difference being this, and this is part of my research, when I looked at how people react to different kinds of impacts, I did a comparative analysis of the impact of the bubonic plagues in Europe and the impact of the epidemics on this continent. And I asked, how did people respond? Now, that's a long study, but let me just tell you what happened. In Europe, the bubonic plagues hit on average every 40 years. And in 40 years, you can do a fair bit of reconstituting. You can reclaim your economies. your population can regrow, you can do a lot of work in 40 years. Some of you understand that because you're around that age. I'm trying to be nice here. On this continent, the epidemics hit on average every 7 to 14 years. So there was no real time for indigenous populations to do the grieving and to do the healing that was necessary to allow them to move forward. And I know as an anthropologist we argue about this all the time as to how much of an impact there was. And we've kind of agreed that there was anywhere from 20 to 112 million people continentally. And at least 75 to 90% of the population wiped out. So think of the impact of that kind of massive death. And with that goes a lot of your knowledge base, your spiritual practices, your political, you know, everything kind of gets affected by that. And so the reconstitution of that is still going on today. On the heels of those epidemics was the removal of lands and from resources, and then came the Indian residential school. And you know, 150 years of that kind of impact, seven generations of children. So I really want to emphasize this in particular, that the people that went into residential schools were children. Anywhere from 3 years of age to 8 years of age, they were put into these schools. Almost 50% of those children died in those schools. Now that's an impact on the children, clearly, but it's a tremendous impact on the community, on the parents and grandparents and relatives that were left at home. And that just finished in 1996, right? So that's a very contemporary trauma. And at the same time as that is going on, we had the 60s scoop, where children were being taken out of their homes. So we had the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s scoop, because it's still happening. And on top of that trauma, we had the missing and murdered indigenous women and girls, young men, happening simultaneously. Because we now know from the conversations that we had across Canada with Dr. Bennett and Minister Wilson and Minister Hadju, that people as long as 60 years ago lost family members that were murdered. And so that has been a simultaneous impact that has been going on up until today. So when you look at the indigenous population and you say, why are we still having this conversation? What is it, this thing about reconciliation, and what does it mean? It means that we have to be aware and accepting of the fact that people have been deeply impacted by multiple events, and we're still working our way through that process. We're doing a good job. I want you to understand that. Also, so let me share something, other things with you. In terms of how impact actually affects this population, as a congregation, as we're sitting here in this beautiful church, if a bomb went off outside, we would all react. Every single person in here would react. We would all react very differently. Some of you would be under the pews or the chairs. Some of you would be running. Some of you would be getting bandages. Some of you would be on your cell phones. Some of you would be absolutely frozen, right? You would all react. And the indigenous population is very much like that. So not everybody in the indigenous population is an alcoholic, and not everybody in the indigenous population is a PhD, right? We have everything from this side of the to this side. And so when you look at the native population, you need to understand that like humans everywhere, and that's what my studies told me during my master's degree, we're in all stages of health, wellness, and healing. Right? That's what's going on. So when you look at the population, I want you to always think about that. And one of the things I say to people all the time, especially conservation officers who I get to talk to a lot, is 97% of the population of Canada has suffered some form of trauma. And the other 3% is lying. Right? We're all in this, right? Every single person in this room has had some kind of an experience of pain or trauma, whether it was a parent dying, a divorce in the family, a lost pet, something. And each one of you found a way to deal with that pain and move yourself forward. And some of you chose substances, and some of you chose alcohol, and some of you chose friends, and some of you chose therapy, and we're in exactly the same place. So I want to dispel a lot of the notion of stereotypes about who Indigenous people are. I'm not a special person in the Indigenous community today. There are many people like me, like Delia, who have become educated and walk in both worlds quite effectively. We go to ceremony, we go to powwows, we enjoy, you know, she speaks the language fluently, I don't. and we also, you know, go to fancy restaurants and drive nice cars. So we've all been there. So that's what you need to know about who we are and how we're proceeding through this world today. I think it's really important. In the context of reconciliation, as we move forward and the conversation broadens from our perspective, some of the things that you need to know about are the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Canada adopted it an aspirational document Prime Minister Harper's government. And now Justin Trudeau's government has said, we'll take it, we'll do it, we'll put it in place, it's, you know, we have adopted it without reservation. It was interesting when they said without reservation, I'm saying, like, no, we still have those. Something we need to get rid of. We still have that. But the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is going to be part of the conversation of reconciliation, a very big part of it. And the reason I want you to understand and have a look at it and know something about it is because, you know, we've heard that it does not necessarily fit with Canada's laws. I mean, the Minister of Justice, Jody Wilson, has said that pretty clearly and unequivocally to us. And so as a question of reconciliation, our question as Canadians is, so how do we deal with these questions? How do we make these things so? How many people, Indigenous people, are there in Canada today? How many people are there? Do you know? Any? Tell me a number. Guess.
3 million.
A little bit less. Okay, so there's about 2 million Indigenous people in Canada today. That's a round number. Okay, maybe about half, well, not even actually that. About 700,000 of them are what we call status Indians. They are recognized formally by the government. It's dropping, that number, by the way. It used to be almost 1 million. It's dropping. And there's lots of reasons for that. How many Canadians are there? Round number. Okay, about 35. Okay, let's say 35 million, right? So there's 2 million Indigenous people. There's 33 million other people, including you, lovely people. How are we going to create reconciliation if we don't all agree that pieces like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples needs to be implemented? 2 million people are not going to make that happen. 35 million people have a good chance. So it means that you as Canadians are going to need to say yes. Now, we have a government right now under Trudeau that has said yes to Indigenous peoples. That's why we're having this conversation. He said, yes, we want to talk nation to nation. Yes, we want to correct the wrongs of the past. Yes, we recognize that there have been mistakes made, and we want to move forward in a good way. So when you look at the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, your ability to speak effectively to that, to your MPs and to your churches, to your neighbors, is going to make the difference in how that happens. So that's a really good point when it comes to looking at reconciliation. It doesn't just mean being a nice person, right? Because, you know, we got a lot of nice people in this room, right? It's not enough to say, yeah, sure, I think Native people are pretty cool, even if you don't really know. We are, by the way. Yeah. You're going to have to do more than that, and it means you're going to have to be interested in understanding. So the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is one thing. The Indian Act, which has been in place since 1876, is another piece. Under the Indian Act, in our communities today, as we speak, our bank councils, most of them are under the Indian Act, have only two things that they have jurisdiction over, and that's garbage and dogs. The rest of it has to go to the Minister of Indigenous Affairs to approve any kinds of laws or rules and regulations, etc., for bank council resolutions. We need to think about that, and we need to change that. Because some of the things that are really important to our communities are the restoration of jurisdiction and authority over their lives, over their very lives, not only on how they run their governments, which they also are subject to when it comes to the government of Canada. They need to have that restored. Another thing that they cannot restore unless we all say yes. Because the Minister of Indigenous and Northern Affairs Canada agrees that First Nations communities should have the right to make choices on their own behalf. But there are laws and legislation in the way of those things becoming realities. So you need to understand that. This is not a simple thing. It's not just somebody will wave a magic wand and things will change. It's going to take a country, a people, and a country together to make it so. So we need to understand. So today, treaties are very much alive and well. We have treaties in this country that need to be implemented. We have self-governing agreements that have been laying dormant for as much as 28 years because there has not been the political will nor the public support to have them implemented. And when we talk about implementation, we're not taking anything away from you. And I think it's really important that you understand that. What Indigenous peoples need is to be included in the conversation generally across Canada. And I say to people all the time, they say, well, it's too expensive to build roads into the north and give them power. I'm like, you did it right across this massive country. From here to BC and east to the very tip of Newfoundland, you can't go up north. So there's other things afoot there, I think. Because in the north, 90% of the population is Indigenous. And where do the resources in this country come from today? North. So there's a sense in the north, where I live in Thunder Bay, that Indigenous peoples are in the way of progress. They are not in the way of progress. They come to the tables today to have the conversations that are necessary to move the entire country forward. At the same time as they're doing that, they're defending your right to clean water. How many of you heard of Idle No More? Anybody here? Okay, look it up. Google it, as Delia says. Google it. Idle No More was initiated by four... Idle No More. Was initiated by four women, two Indigenous, two non-Indigenous, out of Bill C-31, which was one of those omnibus bills, where the protection, the very protection of your waters, your streams, and your lake beds was removed. And there was barely a murmur from the Canadian population about that. But these four women said, I don't think so. And they started to do teach-ins on water. So they're protecting your interests, your children's, and your grandchildren's interests. This is not just about Indigenous people. And as we speak, what's her first name? I can't remember her first name. There's one of the ladies from Fort William is walking the Great Lakes for the last time in her life. She's done it many times. Josephine Mandama, thank you. Josephine, this is her last walk. She's 77 now. She can't do it again. She's walking the Great Lakes not because she hasn't got anything else to do. She's doing this for you and for me to raise awareness that we have to protect these waters. And if you look at Lake Winnipeg in the middle of summer, you're going to understand why. It's completely covered with algae, green algae, toxic algae. So we got lots of work to do as a community, as a people in this particular world. So that's important that you know that. I've already mentioned the question of missing and murdered. We need to know these things that are important. The other thing I want to say to you is the whole question around, who's on side here in the conversation. And I want to share with you, because I want you to think about these things. I was talking to Mr. Martin, Paul Martin, the former Prime Minister, quite a while ago, actually, and we were having this conversation about reconciliation. And he said to me, Cynthia, let me put it to you this way. And he said, and it's not scientific, but this is what you're up against. He said, 40% of the population of Canada is on side. 40% of the population of Canada understands that there have been wrongs that have been perpetuated against the Indigenous population. There is discrimination. There is stereotyping. There is biases and beliefs that we have to address. 30% of the population doesn't really care. They don't want to hear about it. they don't want to know, and if they know anything, it's like, can they just get a job and get on with it? And 30% of the population is on the fence. He said, forget the 30% in the middle. You're never going to be able to convince them that this is important because it's such a small population and for whatever economic, social reasons. Work with the 30% that's sitting on the fence and help them understand how important this is and how significant it is to us as a country to support and understand the indigenous population and their influence in this country and the contributions, and you will have critical mass. And when you have critical mass, you will be able to make those shifts in policy, practice, and law. It's the only way to do it. So just think about that. Are you in the 40%? Are you in the 30%? Are you in the 30% that's sitting on the fence? And let's, because I'm happy to work with you to take that to a place where we can actually do something with it. It's important. Okay, water. Drink water. While I'm, what was that? Something went. All right. So, one of the things I want you to do, right now, is so I've given you sort of a picture of some of the pieces that we're very deeply engaged in conversation about across Canada. Well, one of the other pieces I want to also share with you, because I just came off of, I spent January through the end of March on Minister Bennett's behalf, traveling across the entire country in every single province in the Yukon. And I want you to know something about this country. It's incredible. It is incredible. If you have not had an opportunity to travel across the land in this country, you are missing something. So this summer, take your kids, go. Get on a train. Honestly, incredible. And I had the opportunity while doing that to visit at least 18 First Nation communities. And I went up into the Yukon to Old Crow, which is one of the furthest north communities we have in this country. There's about 84 people living up there. It was February, March, February, March. I went dog sledding at 46 below zero.
Oh, yeah.
Chilly. As a matter of fact, when we got back from the dog sledding, the dogs got away. The lead dogs took off running, and I looked around and I knew where I was, and I jumped off that sled and I ran like heck for the house. I said, "Is she mad?" And I think she's just cold. I knew there was a fire there. These communities are struggling across Canada. The reason I was going across Canada for Minister Bennett as a representative was on child welfare. Because one of the things that's also happening in this country is we have found another way to disempower the indigenous population, and that is to take their children, like we did with residential schools, only now we're doing it in a way of saying we're helping. We're helping, and we're not. I want you to know we're not. We are destroying communities across the board because we think, as a society, that we know better about how to raise children. And where there's some issues or some addictions, we figure we have a better sense of how to treat those addictions and look after those kids than their very parents or grandparents do. And I went up into the other side of the country, into Labrador, up to Shoshashi and to Natsushish, they're hard to say, Natsushish. Their children are being taken and given to Newfoundland. And Newfoundland, the community of Newfoundland, Roddington, is doing great. They're paying their mortgages. They're all reviving the community. The school's now open. But those two communities are struggling, and we're just adding one more burden onto those communities than they already have to suffer with the fact that food's insecurity and housing insecurity and all those other pieces. So very important. If you want to be able to understand how to create reconciliation in First Nation communities, it's by saying we have to stop interfering in people's ability to make choices around who they are, how they raise their children, and how those children grow up in the world. Because I get those children as a professor in my university, and they are not happy to have been removed from their homes. We may think that every child has to have their own bedroom, and that every door needs a door, and that everybody should live the same way. But it is not like that. In remote communities, it is not like that at all. So really important things happening across the country. But I will tell you this, in spite of all of those impacts, these people are incredibly productive, healthy, loving, incredibly loving. I was absolutely welcomed everywhere I went, and they shared what they had, their knowledge, their food, their space, you know, their caring. And yet we still keep taking from them. We've got to learn how to give. And we've got to learn how to say yes to ensuring that they have proper housing, that food insecurity becomes something that is no longer... I mean, this is Canada. This is Canada, not a third world country, and that's how they're treated. So we have lots of things to do. So what I want you to do right now is I want you to just turn to somebody else close by and just ask them, tell them what reconciliation means to you. When we talk about this process, what is it going to look like for you? What did you hear? And what should we, and I want you to share with me. So just, if you find somebody that you don't know, or, you know, that isn't attached to you by a wedding ring or anything like that, just have a little question. Let's have about 3-minute question conversation about what is reconciliation? Just put your hand up. So when you want to, we'd just like to hear back from you some of the conversation that you had. You can share that back with us, and then we're going to have another conversation on the cards, you know, in a couple more minutes. We're going to talk about that too. So go ahead.
Yes, I just want to ask a question about the lack of history in the education system in Canada. Has very, you know, they've neglected to teach about the Indians and the Aboriginals and the Inuit. But what I'd like to know is, do they intend, with all the stories that these people came up with, is it going to be an historical document? Are they going to digitalize the stories that are coming out of the...
residential schools?
Right.
Yes. Yes. Okay, go ahead. I want to answer your question. I'm going to answer your question, but I'm not asking for you for questions right now. I'm asking you to talk about what reconciliation means to you. But it could be that too, right? So one of the things that she's asking about is you know, the Indian residential school files, will they be digitized and available? Some of them already are, and you can go to the Center for Truth and Reconciliation to get that information. Some of the information that is associated to the independent assessment process that Delia was a part of are not available to you because they're private documents, and they will be kept that way probably indefinitely. But there are records that you can get from the center right now, and those records are available to... So what the center is doing is opening up access at universities across Canada so students can have access to those records, and also from libraries. So you will be able to get some, yes. Okay, reconciliation. So somebody, anyone want to share? Yes, go ahead. Oh. Here's a mic right here.
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
My name is George, and I was very interested to attend this talk. I did live in Saskatchewan, northern Saskatchewan, way up by Wishart, and I do know what cold means. I've been particularly interested in this, and I'm going to make it very brief, okay? In my view, having lawyers and governments and provincial people reconciliate is a waste of time. You've had a history to do it. It failed, in my view. Fortunately, I have some viable solutions to the problem.
Okay.
How about that? through the legal viewpoint, I would encourage the law society to let the paralegal people take over and work in this business. There can be huge changes by people who are working at the grassroots of the community. Paralegals do that. Thank you very kindly.
Oh, thank you. All right. Anybody else over here? Reconciliation. What does it mean to you? Go ahead. Way at the back. Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Well, it's basically, I think, a level playing field.
Okay.
Which we have anything but.
Okay, so what do you mean by level? What does a level playing field look like?
A level playing field would be equal opportunity for education,
okay,
for health care,
okay,
for services, for housing, for all of the supports that that we take for granted who live in the south of Canada. And I'm sure there are other areas as well, but we simply don't provide that.
So we need to look north and ensure that people in the north, and there's lots of other people living in the north too, have access to the same kinds of benefits as the rest of Canada, right? Yeah. And it's a challenge. I want you to, so, you know, we haven't had a chance to talk about some of the Inuit communities and the northern remote communities who are struggling, who have fly-in communities. They don't have roads. They don't have access to doctors and people like that. So there's a lot of challenge. There's going to be a lot of expense to that. But it's something I think we can bear as a country if it's done correctly. Yeah, go ahead.
Before I begin my views on reconciliation, I'd like to make a comment about what this gentleman over here said. Yes, our governments have failed, but we should remember we elected them. Mm. We get the governments we deserve. Right? And so we have to be active in ensuring that the people we send to Ottawa, to Queen's Park, etc., represent the views that we want them. I believe that reconciliation really starts with the ending of the Indian Act. Mm. You have control over dogs and garbage. You cannot control what goes on in the reservations if you're doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it starts. And as another thing I think we can do individually, we've just had at our church in Oakville a long session on reconciliation. It was down at the waterfront looking at the plaques that talk about the history of Oakville. Mm-hmm. If I was an Indigenous person, I would feel left out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it began in 1700 when Chisholm bought the town from the Crown.
Right.
Nothing about who lived there before.
Yeah.
And I think once we start doing that, we will move towards reconciliation.
Yeah, that's the inclusiveness, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so including Indigenous people, Indigenous youth in your events and making a special effort. I think that if we did special effort, and it doesn't even have to be a lot, but just think about, you know, inviting kids from, like we have an Indigenous school in our in Thunder Bay, and I work very closely with that school because I want those kids to feel included. So we're trying to work now to set up an academic stream because all they have is an applied stream, which says to those kids, you're not likely to go to university, so we don't need to give you that kind of a challenge. Right? We need to change those things. Do you have a mic, or is it okay?
Who's next here?
Right here, yeah. Right, with this man right here in the gray sweater shirt.
Our group of four was talking about reconciliation, and we kind of recognize when you start to hear a list of 94 things, it's overwhelming. It's hard to relate to it.
Yeah.
So I think we were thinking reconciliation needs to start with First Nations being clear about what are the priorities within that that's reconciliation, and the Indian Act was talked about as a priority. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is about expressing to Canadians in terms they can relate to it at a personal level.
Mm.
So when you talk about the Indian Act, explaining to them about garbage and dogs, how would you feel? Or if you were drinking this water in the city of Toronto, this quality, how would you feel for your children? So expressing it in terms that Canadians can relate to at a personal level.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think there's been a lot of effort to, you know, to do things like that where we've brought out water from... I mean, I lived in a remote community for a year while I was doing my doctoral work in a Muskrat Dam. And I still remember turning on the taps and think I was going to have a bath. And the water that came out was brown and full of things. And I was like, ooh, right? So if that's all you have, right, how do you manage to keep your kids healthy? And it wasn't like it was always like that. It happened over time, right? We've made tremendous impacts. But yes, I agree with you. Make it so people understand it.
To me, reconciliation means getting to know people and understanding them. And that isn't just up in the head. How do we get to know the 50,000 Indigenous people that live right here in Toronto?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we sit here in North Toronto.
Mm.
And how can we facilitate that from both sides?
Yeah. Well, one way you can facilitate knowing Indigenous peoples is by going where they are. And powwows are open to everybody. And they're the perfect opportunity to be in a celebratory place, have some really cool food, you and get into doing some dancing and appreciate the spiritual practices of people, and then you're welcome to do that. And they have lots of them all over Ontario. Take your kids. The Council Fire is a place that does really upgrading education for Indigenous people, and volunteer. Or you have a feast at Christmas, make an invitation. Or go down to the Friendship Center, and there's a Friendship Center in Toronto. There's one in every city, and just get to know them, because you're absolutely correct. When you want to know people, or when you like somebody, what do? You invite them home for dinner, or you go out to dinner, and you break bread, which is a very personal thing to do, right? It's really important. And you know, how many of you have ever had an Indigenous person in your house? I ask Indigenous people too. You know, how many have you ever had a They're like, well, I don't think so. So yeah, we see each other equally strangely from both sides, right? We look at you and think, I don't know. And that, you know, vice versa. So it's not like, you know, they're just waiting for the invitation, trust me. But you know, you get to know people by spending time with people. And I work with a lot of boards across the city. I come to Toronto. I grew up in a household that was for residential school survivors. There was a lot of problems in that household. But here's what made it different for me. I grew up in Toronto. And as I was growing up in Toronto, I have to tell you, it wasn't pleasant going to school all the time, because people have kids are cruel, right? Kids were, you know, like squaw and all this. But I got to meet lots of people. And I got to go to lots of churches. I kind of liked the Baptist church because they had some really cool guitar going on here. And I wasn't really cool with all the genuflecting on the Catholic church. And I never converted. So my mother always said that to me, you know, you're a heathen. I'm like, that's the way to go. But I'm okay, but I have a spiritual practice. And I believe each one of you is a spiritual person, you know, creation. And when I look at you, I was just telling Delia this morning, and I was working with people at the Friendship Center about 15 or 20 years ago. I remember saying to them, I want you to close your eyes. We were in a big circle. And I want you to look at each other. And they're like, well, how do we look at each other if our eyes are closed? I said, oh, I want you to look at the light. I want you to see the spirit in each person in this circle. And I want you to understand that some of you have lights that shine a little brighter than other people. It doesn't make you any better. It doesn't make you any more spiritual. But it does mean you have a brighter light. So hold it up so other people in the dark can find their way. We have to understand that we're all human beings, that we all have a purpose of being here. And maybe that's what it's all about. You know, there's never been a time in I think, Earth's history where everything's been hunky-dory, like everything's just so great. We're all getting along, we like each other. No, never happened. Maybe it doesn't happen because it's not supposed to happen. Maybe we need to be challenged by each other. Maybe we need to understand, you know, that people get elderly, that people are young and impetuous, that people are black and red and white and yellow, and that there's a very good reason for that. And it challenges us to put down the judgment. It challenges us to see not the color or the jewelry or the clothing, but the spirit that lives there. And learn how to be accepting. And we haven't done a very good job of that when it came to the Indigenous population, because somehow people arrived here and thought they knew better, or they were better. And it did a hell of a lot of damage, I must tell you. But we're still here, so that was probably a good reason for that too. And you know, and that just brings me, like, you know, as we talk about the future, and you know, and I do want to get to that because we only have a couple minutes. As we talk about going to the future, I want you to understand that we very, very much are aware of our past, our present, and our future. We know that there's prophecy that told us you were coming. And we know that there's prophecy that tells us now that we're coming to a crossroads. We're coming to a fork in the road that is asking humanity to think very carefully about where it's going to go tomorrow. And one of those forks is going to take us to, apparently, from the elders, as I hear it, utter destruction, overdevelopment, technology, you know, disconnection, and all those things that will ultimately destroy us. Or we're going to go the other way, which takes us back to understanding this planet and our responsibility to live on it well and to protect those waters, because we are not doing a good job of that. Not doing a good job of that. Let me share a story with you from Christian Island. I've been to India a couple times, and I've stood and crossed over the Ganges River, terrified. Please do not let me fall in here, because I will never be found again. I had never seen water so damaged in my entire life. Anyway, I invited one of those Indian professors back to Canada, and we took him up to Christian Island in Georgian Bay for a powwow. And we stood on the shore of Georgian Bay, and we looked into the water. And if you've ever been to Georgian Bay, you can see to the bottom. And I said, yes, that is what water is supposed to look like. And then I thought, but this water is clearer than I've ever seen it before. And I had been there about 4 or 5 years before. And you know how the rocks get a little grungy and slippery looking? It wasn't like that. And I thought, that's really common. That's really cool. It looks really clean. So I went to Christian Island, and I asked the elders. I said, I noticed that the lake and the water is so clean. And they said, yes, we've been working very hard on that. And I said, really? I said, what have you been doing? He said, we've been praying for it. And we have been putting down tobacco every day. I said, well, it's working. So if they can do something like that, you think about in the congregations of your churches, if you actually took the time to pray for the waters and pray for the land, what an impact you might be able to make. I have had students say to me, you know, when I first came to your classes, I used to pray for myself. Do you please give me a better job? Please give me a better husband. Oh, I'm sure they didn't say that. Please give me whatever. And she said, and since I've been in your classroom and listening to Indigenous people come and talk, she said, now I know that I need to pray for other people. And I need to pray for the betterment of them. And it's changed my life. We can do that. And I think we need to consider it. If we want to hit reconciliation as a country, as a people, it's not just about being nice. It's not. It's about being kind. Because nice is something, and your mother told you to be nice, right? But being kind comes from the heart. And being kind takes you to other places. And it gives you other intentions. And it gives you other values and principles. And it gives you an ability to reach out and touch people where they live and change for the better. So that's what we want. That's what we need to do. That's where we want to go. So we have about 2 minutes. I had handed out some of the calls to action that are quite technical, as you can see. If anybody has had a look at them and wants to share a thought, because one of the things we need you to do is we need to action your intentions. We need to action your commitments, and you need to think about what could you do as a church? And I'm not asking you to do, you know, to change the world tomorrow, right? I've given you 20 years. I've given you some time. But what do you think? Anybody want to share some thoughts on what you've got there before in the next couple minutes? Oh, you got the microphone. You want to share anything, Malter? Because we're done it. Like, okay.
Be careful, Malter. Okay.
Oh, over here. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. On the native reserves, I don't care if you have your own rule of law, but in the rest of Canada, I think the law should be straightforward, and no one's culture should be infringing on it. Because right now you've got some situations in some European countries where they're trying, security forces are trying to appeal to all different cultures, and you've got some policemen having to take off their shoes when they're going in to investigate a criminal. Okay, so it's making a mockery, okay, of security forces. So you have to wonder who's putting across some of these ideas, because it's creating certain advantages. And organized crime is huge all over the West. It's on the native reserves, And this is what is attacking your youth, and it's why people are landing in jail. Okay, so you've got a drug problem with the native kids. We've got a drug problem with the white kids. Okay, kids are dying all over the place. And it's organized crime backing it. And they're making huge money, and they're not being held to account. Everybody's very good at holding the government to account and saying, why aren't you doing this? And then they're criticizing security forces at the same time. Now, why? Where are these ideas to criticize security forces? Is it to make them impotent so that they don't actually get the criminal? You have to always think about the criminal intent behind any policy. And that's not what we've been doing. We've been doing it, this group against the government. And the criminal is coming up right through the middle and getting everything they want.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, that is an important conversation. There's no question that there are concerns and issues across the country, and every country, not just Canada, United States. I don't think we can solve that in the next couple of minutes, but I think that it's a kind of conversation that is, you know, that we have to have awareness of, that we have concerns, and that criminal, why do people become criminals? You know, I mean, that's a big question, and it, you know, and the Indigenous community isn't any more criminal than anybody else, you know, but there is poverty. Poverty is certainly a push towards criminality. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and mental illnesses are pushes towards criminality because people cannot get work. But they use people that are in those positions to help to get to the, where they're going. Okay, that's a conversation that we probably won't be able to have today, but yeah, go ahead.
Stego. I'm Daryl Dockstader from Six Nations. This is a wonderful discussion to have, and I like the fact that Jesus would talk in parables to get the message across. So I have 2 points. Yesterday was Earth Day. Mm-hmm. Reconciliation will occur when Western society sees Earth Day 365 days of the year,
yes,
rather than just the one. And the other is a short little story. I imagine you've heard of stories where, in order to teach students empathy, they bring little babies into school. And there was this one individual, he was very withdrawn. He was a product of various orphanages. And this baby was really upset and crying, and typical stage where only a mother would love. And they asked, who would like to hold the baby? And surprisingly, this kid who was abused himself raised his hand. And he picked up the baby, and the baby automatically settled down and quieted. And he held him for the hour. And at the end, he asked the teacher, do you think somebody who has never been loved could be a good father? Mm. When we no longer have that, that's when we'll have reconciliation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yes, you want to share something?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, first of all, acknowledge Daryl's own commitment and courage in this respect. I was involved as one of counsel for parties in the Caledonia matter. And Daryl, at a time of considerable conflict and in proceedings which have kind of been described as the rule of law proceedings, tried to tread a path of reconciliation between communities that were hostile, both within the Indigenous Six Nations Haudenosaunee community, communities of lawyers and issues of law, communities who sought development and property rights and title rights, and had disregard for customary rights and claims. So I salute. I was astonished to see you stand here today, so I wanted to acknowledge that. I think the issues of reconciliation go deeply, involve both the spiritual, as you spoke of, but principally ones of understanding, that when the concept of truth and reconciliation is considered, the challenging of what is truth, and then trying to incorporate that in discussion and in understanding and in response to various of the issues that you've outlined, whether they be 94 or 2, they're all matters that we have to consider. So thank you for your work today, and thank you, Daryl.
Thank you. Okay, one other here. Can you reach it?
I thank you for your presentation. I think that reconciliation comes from breaking bread together. We've just gone through Easter week, and the idea of people eating together, having communal food is very important. I believe that Toronto has benefited from the number of cultures that have brought their foods, and it's the way that we in Toronto have got to know each other. There's a restaurant in Kensington Market, Sean Adler's Indian Fish Tacos. I recommend it to you all.
Dinner. Thank you. Okay. There's a train coming. Anybody else? Oh, here she comes.
I'm here just by chance because I attended this church and I didn't realize this was going on, so I'm glad I'm here. I immigrated here about 50 years ago, and at the time when, hockey was the big culture and all, I couldn't see a puck on the ice that was shown on the ice, but it took me almost 30 years before I can follow where the puck is. And my initial understanding of the First Nation at that time was through arts and entertainment, really. The Bonanza was shown, and all the futures, struggling to learn English at that time, but you can still follow the story, and all the First Nations characters that are shown in the arts and entertainment were always up against some kind of advancement of the main characters, and I still don't remember the main characters of the portrayed in the First Nation. But I do remember other characters.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, arts and entertainment have a strong influence in influencing young people and sort of leaving any sort of a long-term memory. So that's how I understand. So it took me a long time to understand the reconciliation issues that have been going on in Canada, even though I'm Canadian now.
Yeah.
What can arts and entertainment do at this time? Because a lot of young people are absorbing there aren't too many young people here. Mm-hmm. So how do we...
She said, I beg your pardon?
I'm talking about 20s, okay? All right.
So yeah.
All right.
Aboriginal People's Television Network is trying to do a lot. You know, it's got the First Nations, the Inuit are represented there. You know, the Métis people have an opportunity to put, you know, sort of put their stuff out there. But one of the things we have to stop doing. How many of you saw The Revenant? The Revenant, yeah. So in The Revenant, there's a section where I walked out. Where they have, little native girls being dragged around by these, you know, hairy trappers, right? And it's like, really, was that necessary? Because all that does is subliminally say, that's what they're for. You know, but when you see imagery like that, it has a very profound effect on people's minds. Like you said, you know, you look at that, it kind of flashes by. It's like the way they make you eat popcorn, right? You know, it's subliminal, but it's there. And we've got to stop allowing that to happen. And we put out now video work, and kids are amazing with digital everything, right? So they're putting it out there. It's happening. The principals, or the presidents of universities, have put 13 principles forward to embed Indigenous learning in universities. the deans of education are doing the same thing. The principals of high schools are doing their level best to get information in. Mandatory, you know, indigenous or Indian residential school stuff. Like it took, like I said when I started, it took 600 years to get us to this conversation. It's going to take some time so that it becomes a normative thing to have indigenous history, which we now, you know, Aboriginal history, now called indigenous history, actually in place, where people don't go, oh, really? Or why are we talking about that? It'll just be, people will just know that in this territory, you know, you're under Treaty 1818, and then, you know, there's a number of treaties, and that it's part of Canada's long-standing history. In Thunder Bay, I had the Chamber of Commerce say to me, well, why did they keep coming here? I was like, excuse me, they've been coming here for 11,000 years. You've been here for 350. And the only reason you have a city is because of the trading routes that were set up. So we need to know that.
So the underlying question on my part is that even if we truly find an answer at this moment in time, how do we, because the younger generations are still coming up and then the years will go by, how do we continually make that truth stay as truth? And continue to perpetuate to the generation after. And I think in arts and entertainment do have, I believe in the political system, educational system, along with this mass media system as well.
We just got to keep doing it.
Right.
And we got to keep showing our kids. And you got to watch what you say. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, you say things in the privacy of your own home, it's not private anymore. You know, you say, what you say, and I say the same thing to our people. What you say at the dinner table, your kids will take out on the street and make it real. And if that's stereotypes, if that's fear, that's what they're going to take out to the street. And it doesn't matter what the background is. This lady over here, that doesn't matter what the background is. We need to be vigilant as people, as human beings.
This just refers to what you said, that used to be Aboriginal, we now call it Indigenous. What terms are inappropriate? Like, I was out in Alberta at the Calgary Stampede, and they choose the Indian princesses. Mm-hmm. And somebody said to me, ooh, they do? And so, so anyway, what I wondered, are there is there any terminology which is improper?
Well, you know, there still is an Indian act. You know, I mean, and you know, and I always tell people, when my mother was alive, at, you know, at 76, and she said, Indian, I didn't correct her, and trust me, neither would you. She grew up with that, right? So, you know, she used that term. In the United States, they still say Indian, right? I think the best thing I always tell people is ask. What would you like? What terminology would you like me? What's appropriate? And a lot of communities don't even want you saying Indigenous. They want you to, or Aboriginal, or Native. They want you to say Haudenosaunee, and, you know, and Unguhungwe, and they want you to say the, you know, whatever they happen to be. They want you to use that language because that is their language. And the words you use every day, Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, Saskatchewan, Winnipeg, are all Indigenous words. You know, you don't even realize how much. If you guys want to read a book and understand how much Indigenous people have contributed to this country, read Jack Weatherford's book. It's called Indian Givers. Right? So just remember the little phrase, like, you're such an Indian giver. Yeah. Well, it's actually true. And read that book, and it'll talk to you about the influence on the Constitution of the United States, Benjamin Franklin's work, all of the people that studied the Haudenosaunee Great Law, which was in place, by the way, in 1050. How do we know it was in 1050? Well, we know it was in 1050 because when you iterate the Great Law, in it are events, celestial events and otherwise, that scientists said, oh yeah, actually those things did occur in those times. That's a round number. But the fact of the matter is, when people came here and said this is a lawless place, they were absolutely wrong. There was law all across the entire country. There was governance. There was spiritual practices. There were trade routes. There was economy. All of those things met destruction under a contact, a brutal force of contact that brought epidemics and brought warfare and brought dislocation. And you read, what's his name, Charles Mann, 1491. He took all of the history that had been shoved aside as irrelevant and brought it back into a text that talks about the things that are there in the record, because people kept records. So, you know, there's lots of things that we have convenient. Tom, what's his name? Wrote The Inconvenient Indian. You know, like the fact that people are perceived as being in the way. They live differently. I have been up in the Labrador coast, up the other side of the coast, across the country, and believe it or not, people still are living their traditional ways, you know, teaching their cultures and their languages, and they don't want to be like you, whatever you means. They want to be who they are. And we have, as a society, done our level best to deprive them of that privilege, of that right, because we think we know better. And we have taken their children and turned them into something that they don't recognize. And we have taken their lands and waters and created destruction. And we have created things that we, I mean, I've had people tell me, we have an economy in this country, in the United States, is like a crack addict. It knows it's bad for it, but it still wants more. And we have a society that never gets to enough. So we have to think about those things as a society, slow it down. And, you know, and today the average size of a house, no offense to anybody living in the neighborhood, but the average size of a house today is like 4,000 square feet or something. You don't need houses that big anymore. We don't, you know, but we leave big footprints, right? So we have to think about what are we doing as a society? How do we make it possible for this world to be here in this beautiful country that we live in, to host next generations? Richard.